always say, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. But what if you meet someone who can make your dreams come true? You're on vacation at a ski resort with your new best friend. You spend time together. Do some business together. You even buy each other gifts. But what you don't do is catch on to him before he checks out. In true crime, investigation and conviction may take years. But every detective knows that the crucial clue is always there, somewhere, in the first 72 hours. RCMP officers receive a call from a local businessman. Corporal John Stein takes the report.
From the appearance, he was a successful businessman, and he had a public company that he was looking for investors. I think over his lifespan, he had several companies that he had taken public and profited from them.
The businessman, Martin Gifford, tells Stein he was shocked to find $50,000 of unexpected charges on a recent company credit card bill. His friend and major investor, Michael Van Hoven, has just gone missing. Gifford fears there may be a connection.
Michael Van Hoven was brought to him through another person and introduced as a potential investor in his business because he was looking to invest in some companies in Vancouver.
The two men first met 5 weeks earlier. Gifford needed investors for his latest invention, a groundbreaking advance in ultrasound technology. The more Gifford told Van Hoven about the invention, the more enthusiastic Van Hoven became. He said it was the kind of thing that could make a man rich. Van Hoven insisted on paying for the meal. Wealthy and eager to invest, Van Hoven looked to be the perfect partner. Gifford asked Van Hoven to come by his office as soon as possible to work out the details.
They talked terms of contracts and everything else and what he was looking for in an investment, and they came to some sort of terms.
Van Hoven's initial investment was to be $5 million. His family's bank in Switzerland would wire Gifford the money. Van Hoven wanted their business dealings kept private. He asked that Gifford sign a confidentiality agreement. Gifford agreed. To celebrate their new partnership, Gifford presented Van Hoven with a $28,000 Rolex watch. When Van Hoven left his office that day, Gifford says he was excited. With Van Hoven's backing, he could start planning an early retirement. Two weeks later, Van Hoven's wife and son arrived in Vancouver. Gifford helped the family find an apartment in his building. After years of living alone, Gifford was happy to have people around him again. He felt he'd found not only a business partner, but a friend. Van Hoven and his family included Gifford in everything they did. Van Hoven even bought Gifford a new pair of skis. He insisted he join the family on an upcoming holiday in Whistler. Gifford rented an SUV so they could all drive up together. But Van Hoven said there was a problem. He couldn't book a hotel room without a credit card.
Michael Van Hoven said he didn't have a credit card because he normally doesn't carry credit cards with him. So he had the use of the businessman's credit card to hold the hotel.
Gifford was happy to put the Van Hoven's reservation on his card. Van Hoven said he'd pay cash once they got there. In Whistler, Gifford saw Van Hoven, his wife Teresa, and their son Jean-Marc every day. They skied together, and when Van Hoven and his wife went out, Gifford babysat. A few days into their vacation, Van Hoven introduced Gifford to a local businessman.
He had hooked up with a real estate agent in Whistler and was going around to see properties.
Van Hoven was looking to buy a house in Whistler. 2 weeks into the Whistler vacation, Van Hoven announced his Swiss banker father wanted to meet the man his son had invested so much money in. So while Van Hoven and his family remained in Whistler, Gifford flew off to Geneva. But the Geneva meeting did not go as planned. Van Hoven's father had scheduling problems. Every day, there was another delay.
And he ended up spending about 3 or 4 days in a hotel in Geneva, but the meeting never materialized.
When Gifford returned home, he was surprised to find the SUV he had rented in the apartment garage. The Van Hovens were not due back from Whistler for another week. Anxious to discuss his Geneva trip with Van Hoven, Gifford knocked on his friend's door, but found no one home. He called the family a couple of times and left messages, but no one called back. Finally, he slipped a note under Van Hoven's door. But days later, there was still no response. Gifford then received his $50,000 credit card bill. He says he felt at that point he had no choice but to call the police.
They see the vehicle, it looks like it's abandoned. They leave a note under the door and they can see it hasn't been disturbed. So then all the alarm bells, I think, start to go off.
Corporal John Stein must now find out what has happened to Gifford's friend and to Gifford's money. Vancouver RCMP investigators are looking into the disappearance of venture capitalist Michael Van Hoven, his wife, and his child. Corporal John Stein first tries to determine whether Van Hoven is still in the country.
We had contacted our border to see if they could verify whether or not there was a Michael Van Hoven that crossed at the border. On top of that, I'd made calls to Whistler, to the detachment up there, to see if they had anything.
Whistler police talked to real estate developer Don Wensley, the last person to do business with Van Hoven. Wensley recalls the first time he and Van Hoven met.
I said, "Hi, how are you? What are you looking to accomplish?" And he said, "I want to buy a house. I want to buy a castle." And I said, "Well, we're not big on castles in Whistler at the moment." And then it dawned on me, there was a castle. Private gate, butler's quarters, coach house for the cars and the limo. And it was a gorgeous, gorgeous place looking out over the lake, totally private. And it was $10 million. He had an emotional orgasm when he walked in the front door. And he just said, "This is perfect. This is exactly what we need." The next day, he wrote an offer for $8 million and it was accepted.
Van Hoven had a Swiss bank make the arrangements. He told Wensley a $500,000 deposit would be arriving soon. Wensley tells Whistler police, Van Hoven then presented him with a confidentiality agreement. While Wensley found this unusual, he thought about the large commission he stood to make on the sale and let it go. Police discover that Van Hoven's favorite Whistler hangout was the Barefoot Bistro. Owner André Saint-Jacques remembers the client very well.
He would walk from, like, you know, to the bar to his table, like it was almost like some people had never been in the restaurant could have possibly thought that he was the owner. He had this sort of like air of like feeling that, you know, this is where he belongs and so on. And he used the Barefoot definitely as his headquarters.
Police learn Van Hoven entertained at the bistro constantly. In just 5 weeks, he spent tens of thousands of dollars here.
He would actually charge his bill to the hotel where he was staying at. And I guess he'd go through pricing on the wine list, and ones that were more expensive, he would just sort of order. The Moët et Chandon 1914 is $10,000. Petrus 70 is $3,200. A Dom Pérignon 59 is $2,500. But if you sort of like start asking him any questions, I think he had this way of like sort of having two sides of him. One is very charming, another one he could be like very aggressive, and you know, you felt like, yeah, this guy's gonna kill me.
Driving in the car, and he said, "What's that on your arm?" And I said, "It's a tattoo. I was a fighter pilot." He said, "Have you ever killed anybody?" I said, "What kind of a question is that?" He says, "You have, haven't you?" And I pulled the car over to the side of the road, and I said, "Michael, if you mention it again, I'm going to throw you out of the car."
Don Wensley also saw Van Hoven's dark side. Wensley tells police that the last he heard, Michael Van Hoven had left Whistler. Wensley has given up all hope of ever seeing the $500,000 deposit. The stories Stein hears from Whistler police confirm his suspicions. He pays Martin Gifford another visit.
So I think the first part of it was trying to convince the businessman that this did appear to be a con artist and that he wasn't going to be coming back.
Gifford wants to believe that it's all been just a misunderstanding.
He still thought that the deal might be going through, and that was part of his concern for bringing the police in, because if he had brought the police in and Michael Van Hoven had showed up with a check or several checks, you know, he would have been embarrassed.
Stein is familiar with fraud, but he's never come up against anyone quite like Michael Van Hoven.
It's rare in my job to get an actual con artist that does this traveling roadshow type of thing. He's probably moved on, we might not catch him.
The only evidence Stein has is the rented SUV. He has a team search the vehicle for clues. Stein's partner, RCMP Corporal Cara McMillan, leads the search.
It was all their own, their personal belongings were in there, in the suitcases that were inside the vehicle, but there were no fingerprints.
Within 72 hours of receiving Martin Gifford's call, police get their first break. Inside the suitcase, Corporal McMillan finds several passports bearing different names and a checkbook belonging to Christopher Rocancourt. Cara McMillan begins to process the evidence. Late that afternoon, she does a search on the internet.
I just thought I would try these at the end of the day before going home, one last ditch attempt to locate this guy.
Nothing comes up for Michael Van Hoven, but Christopher Rocancourt is a different story. Investigators are astonished at what they find. Rocancourt is a French citizen. In America, he's posed as a French member of the Rockefeller family and the nephew of film producer Dino De Laurentiis. He has defrauded almost everyone he has ever met, from Hollywood film stars to fortune seekers in the Hamptons. He is wanted by Interpol, the FBI, and various American police departments. But that's not all.
We ran the name Christopher Rocancourt as well on the U.S. database that keeps track of criminals. There was a hit that stated that Christopher Rocancourt was considered to be armed and dangerous.
Rocancourt once threatened to kill a Los Angeles police officer and his family. When cornered, he has always shown a willingness to use violence. Christina McMillan contact Martin Gifford. They tell him Michael Van Hoven's real name is Christopher Rocancourt, and that Rocancourt is one of the world's most wanted con artists. Then they tell Gifford what he needs to do if Rocancourt is going to be caught.
I instructed the businessman to act as if everything is normal, you know, to think that the deal's still going to happen. And that's what happened, actually. He ended up making a couple of calls.
Rocancourt says he's busy sorting out the money transfer in Geneva. Once the conversation's over, Gifford enters a special code that allows police to trace the call. Police discover it was made on Rocancourt's cell phone, which means it could have been made from anywhere.
Our biggest concern was tracking him down and how far ahead he was going to be ahead of us, and you know, we thought maybe he would be out of the country.
Police know Rocancourt could be armed and dangerous. They just don't know where he is. Dangerous con man Christopher Rocancourt has robbed Vancouver businessman Martin Gifford of his money, his future, and his faith in people. The object of a worldwide manhunt, Rocancourt is now on the run. Rocancourt's phone calls are the only lead police have. For those calls to be traced, Gifford has to keep Rocancourt talking.
It was going to bide us time in order to get the transcripts from the cellular telephone company and track down where these phone calls were being made from.
The calls are traced, not to Geneva, but to Victoria, British Columbia, just 100 kilometers away. Sergeant Alan Cochran, then head of the Victoria Police Emergency Response Team, now learns that a dangerous fugitive is at large in his community.
What we try to do is to use the best trained, best equipped people when we're going to deal with high-risk violent offenders, and that's why the emergency response team was brought in.
Rocancourt and his family are staying at the Oak Bay Beach Hotel. Cochran places the hotel under surveillance. At 9 o'clock, Cochran decides to move on Rocancourt.
Our plan at the time was to call up to the room and say that his car was broken into and if he could come down to see if anything had been stolen. And then when he came down, that we would do a high-risk takedown arrest on him. He had been eluding the police for quite some time, so not only violent, but an escape risk. So weren't sure exactly what levels he would go to evade being arrested.
Cochran and his team set out for the hotel.
Just as we were getting on to Beach Drive, Mr. Rocancourt pulled out and we ended up passing each other nose to nose.
Cochran decides to take down Rocancourt right away.
He was really shocked, I think. You know, like it happened so fast and you're kind of overwhelmed. The first thing he said was, they brought the FBI SWAT team in to get me. We kind of had a chuckle about that it was the local Victoria team.
The man Alan Cochran and his team now have in custody has eluded police capture for years. Christopher Rocancourt's arrest makes headlines around the world. Gifford is relieved to hear the news, but he still feels like a fool.
Once you realize that you've been had, it probably hits home harder knowing that, you know, everything in here was kind of a prop used to rip you off.
Rocancourt won Gifford over with his charm, his acts of generosity, and with his displays of wealth.
It keeps him off his feet. It keeps him from having time to think about what's actually happened. And that's, you know, why he was an effective con artist. And once you, it's, you know, like fishing. Once you hook the fish, you have to work the fish.
The confidentiality agreements were just a distraction. designed to demonstrate that Rocancourt had serious intentions.
In like any con, you have to keep the person at bay, and you do that by throwing different things at them, and in this case, buying the houses, you know, $10 million. It kept the businessman from learning the truth.
Don Wensley is philosophical about the experience.
All of us got had, basically, because of our own greed. And when he was arrested, I almost felt sorry. It's nuts. I should have been ecstatic that they've corralled this little bugger. But you know, I think I'd almost hire him as a salesman. He is so good.
Unlike Don Wensley, Martin Gifford has had a much harder time coming to terms.
The businessman suffered from this. It affected his life. It affected his livelihood. It affected the public company. When you say no one gets hurt, just because you don't have the bruises doesn't mean it doesn't affect you.
Christopher Rocancourt has apologized to no one. In his autobiography, he says, "The shinier the hook, the more the fish bite." After serving a year in Canada, Rocancourt was sent to prison in the United States. Once he has completed his 5-year sentence there, he will be deported back to France to face further charges. The stories on 72 Hours are true. The detectives and forensic scientists are the ones who actually worked on the case.